The basic concepts upon which the book Self-Unfoldment was written. There is one more undertone or undercurrent which I would like to especially emphasize. We know that the human being grows primarily through experience. And experience is a participation, an actual doing. It is not merely an observation as one separate from an action, nor is it a kind of instruction in which we seek to benefit principally from the achievements of others or the records of ancient ways and manners. The entire concept of experience is immediate and vital, and there can be no change wrought in the nature of man without the dynamic of experience. It must naturally follow that all disciplines set up philosophically to advance the unfoldment of man's nature must in some way lead to or participate in experience. Now, man may experience outwardly through the testimonies of his sensory perceptions, or he may experience inwardly through the testimonies of certain other powers or faculties within himself. By experience, all processes of growth are given life, are made to be alive, so that we grow not by living upon the dead, but by living upon life. For the moment knowledge is dead, it can no longer give life. So long as we depend upon words or formulas or attitudes which have no immediate vitality in them, we are deprived of the nutrition upon which spiritual achievement must grow in order to attain its proper maturity. Thus we have in the older disciplines certain concentrative exercises that have as their peculiar purpose that man shall experience something within himself, that his concept of I believe shall be transformed into a deeper and more sustaining conviction, I know. This changing of believing into knowing is possible in outward things through participation. The man who studies carpentry for a lifetime must yet pick up the hammer and the saw and create something if he is to know the meaning of the great concept of carpentry. All theory may contribute, but only does it give the skill for actual achievement. The achievement must be, or the experience is deficient. Now, it is not possible for man in the search for interior value to merely use the experience instruments which he has developed for material things. He must have new kinds of experiences. And these are to a measure made possible by a kind of visualization, the actual interior experiencing of something held to be true, known to be sacred, and regarded as of the most primary importance. Concentrational and meditational procedures, therefore, involve a gradual transformation of method, leading in the end to the individual actually being part of something, sharing in insight, rather than merely beholding truth as from a distant mountain. Thus we have in most of our older disciplines the belief that the mandala, or the concentration image, gradually attains a life of itself, so that man beholds with inner faculty the very processes which he first intellectually recognizes in the symbolic diagrams and figures. Thus, these figures seem to come to life, as in the story of the Zen mystics. These things abstractly contemplated suddenly become real, and in their reality they impinge themselves upon our consciousness as experience. We can think about a tree. We can examine the tree. We can spend a lifetime studying its species and its distribution upon the earth. We may, as physicians, consider it for its possible remedial qualities. We may build houses of its wood. We may thatch roofs with its branches. Yet all of these give us only certain experiences of the tree. The doctor's experience is that peculiar to the physician. He discovers the tree to be an agent of healing. The carpenter sees in it the rough materials of his work and transforms it into various shapes, chairs and tables and walls. He also has an experience of trees, a very simple one, but a very direct one. So a dozen different persons with different interests will each have a different experience of this tree. The tired and weary person will rest in its shade and give thanks for its branches. Birds will nest in its clustered twigs. All these experiences are about trees. No one can deny their validity. Yet we search even deeper, because man, endowed with other faculties than those for superficial acquaintance, must search for the mystery of tree in itself. He seeks to experience the life of tree, and he realizes that this life flows outward through the branches reaching out to light and air. He sees and senses the tree as a living, total being. And in the study of its total expression, man becomes acutely aware of the tree's symbolic expression of the great principles of nature. The tree is a symbol of eternal life growing up, growing out as man grows, in a slightly different and more diagrammatic way, but no less proofful or truthful in its depiction. To feel or know the life of the tree requires that kind of constant attention and understanding that we may attribute to the dedicated gardener who gives his life to growing things. He has discovered more than the carpenter can ever know. And yet, perhaps, this other, deeper man cannot build a chair. There are degrees of insight. But that degree of insight which seeks deepest into the life of things is the truest. And the purpose of our concentration processes is always to break through into causes, into the very facts and substances, into the deepest message and insight, and to transform all objects into a mysterious celestial language by means of which we can read the way of the infinite through created things. Thus, if we take a tree or a flower or a plant or a concentration symbol, we may first say that it is very beautiful. And because perhaps we are a little hurt by life, we like to escape the beauty. Here is peace. Here is tranquility. Here is the calmness that perhaps our tired souls desire. But all this is of ourselves only. So wonderful as it may appear, this flower, this plant, is not really stillness or quietness or calmness at all. It is life. Life ever moving, ever dynamic, ever creative. It is just as real, just as dynamic, as the life around us which we find so burdensome and exhausting and wearying. The reason why we are not aware of these things is because by its very nature, the flower conceals most of the machinery of its own striving and its own struggle. Its growth is so slow, we cannot see it. But in the course of days, we notice the changes. So actually, while we may be seeking rest, our symbol is itself an emblem of motion. It is an emblem of dynamics. If it is not dynamic, it is not alive. So we go on from perhaps concentration as this moment of poise in a day of stress and begin to seek not our own comfort, but the greater wisdom of things. And slowly our concentration symbol proceeds to ask us questions. And this flower, which has no tongue, demands answers. These answers can only be discovered by contemplation, by drawing upon the deepest resources of ourselves, by using all that we have ever learned or studied or known, pointing all knowledge toward the simple answer, what is a tree? What is a flower? Why are these things? And what do they mean to us? In the time, of course, the flower or the tree will take on greater and more living importance. We will begin to see in it the long shadow of laws, of principles, of truths and processes. Perhaps our own false doctrines will be naturally censored by this silent blossom. Although it has no tongue, it speaks with an infinite number of voices, calling upon us in myriad ways to search in ourselves for the meaning of everything that exists. So as time goes along in this meditational process, perhaps we shall pass beyond the flower or beyond the tree. We shall see it gradually fade away because we have passed through its shape or shadow and are again searching its substance, which, like our own, is formless. But always, as we proceed, we shall be experiencing something of life. We shall be sharing intuitively in a process of wonderful discovery. It will seem as though innumerable centers of light burst in our consciousness, opening like flowers, telling us things that previously we had not dared that we would ever know. And this way, our concentration moves into dynamics. It moves into meaning and power. that goes on, no longer merely a process of looking at something, or even trying to forget everything else and staring ourselves into an astigmatism. This is not it. It is by degrees a wonderful relaxation in which it seems as though our discoveries are sort of floated in the air around us. With almost no effort, we keep on growing, simply because we no longer resist growth. Growth is effortless, unless man chooses to force or distort its processes. In this way, we gain a sharing in an adventure of life. Now, someone has written to me and asked me, if mathematical symbols are suitable for the mandala processes. They most certainly are. For one of the oldest masters of these sacred arts was Pythagoras of Samos, to whom the world is indebted for many of its most basic mathematical discoveries. A great and wonderful mandala symbol of 47 problems actually invented by Pythagoras. Other wonderful mandala processes are the symbols of number. Individuals can take the number one, draw it on a piece of paper, paint it upon canvas, or place a carved representation of it on a stand before it. And in the presence of this number, it may be solved. Entire mystery of that mystery. For if he can exhaust the number of one, he will exhaust all numbers which arise in it and return to it again. He will exhaust all principles, for it is representative of the principle of principles. He will gradually come to know all processes and all miracles of creation. How does such a discovery vary from the simple study of math, or of geometry, or of trigonometry and health? The difference is very obvious. You may study things, and if you study your mathematics as a small boy, you will learn that 2 and 2 make 4. And having made this discovery, you will be very wise in your own conceit, and hopelessly ignorant of the nature. You will go on. You will multiply and add and divide. And you will work out problems to discover how many square feet there are in a floor, or how many apertures there are in a certain amount of air space. You can learn all kinds of things. You can also go into spherical and into all kinds of trigonometrical formulas. But if you are merely learning to add up a grocery bill or to work out some plan of mechanics or to discover some abstract principle of perspective, that which you attain is measured by that which you desire to attain. Thus you may be a mathematician without ever having sense in mathematics the mystery of the universe. You may intellectualize and say, well, in mathematics we have our single certainty. Even this does us no good. Oh, the world is full of certainties, which, though true in themselves, still leave us ignorant. Mathematical formulas which lead to the contemplative world are like those of the Tetragrammaton profession, the Pyramid of God, or the mysterious development of the inner surfaces and dissections and bisections of cubes, and many other things relating to cones and various mysteries of numbers. All of these, as Pythagoras pointed out, can lead to illumination. But not unless they are approached by
concentration.
By the concentrated method,
having discovered, as Plato so wisely noted, that God's geometry, that the universe is a magnificent formula,
man can come to experience this formula by aid of numbers. However, he can study numbers and never experience this formula at all. He may be like the man who lives in the great city and never visits its art galleries or its museums or its places of interest until a country relative comes to visit. That we are in the midst of knowledge does not mean that we must know. It only means that we have the opportunity to, if we so desire and so apply ourselves. Other persons in various interests and activities have also wanted to know if their peculiar interests are suitable for contemplation. Here the Tibetan and the Japanese and the Chinese mystic tell us the simple fact of life. All trades are manga. All professions are manga. Every art and craft is a mandala. For actually, there is no form of knowledge that exists which is not a key to universes. For nothing can function adequately. No science can be perfected. No art can be matured except by a cooperation with universal law. The law is in everything. It is the privilege of man to find the law. He may find it in the most complicated researches in physics and astronomy. He may find it in the actuarial tables of an insurance company. Whatever he is doing, he is achieving because he is moving in a law. Now, the fact that he knows this, however, will not save him nor serve him over well. He may have a strange respect for it. He may be able to toss it away and say, the universe is wonderful. He is not speaking untruly, but he is speaking without libido, without energy, without meaning. It is only when, for a particular purpose, he takes hold of his knowledge and decides to grind, mold, or trim from this knowledge a key by which he can unload or unlock the mystery of total knowledge. Only then is this knowledge of value, of lasting spiritual significance to himself. If we know that a tailor cannot cut his cloth or a sailmaker his sail without the infinite being present, we gain a new respect for the dignity of simple things. And this is good. Because if truth was only to be found in the most remote or rare or inaccessible of places, the majority of mankind could have no share in it. But truth is more common than the common man. It is more available and inevitable than any product that we have. One of the old alchemists said that the secret and substance of the stone is not rare or difficult, although that which is produced from it is rare and difficult. The materials necessary for the rose diamond are more common than the earth upon which we walk, and each man every day throws away the substances of the elixir of eternal life. The symbolism is adequate enough, regardless of how we may feel about this particular concept. In her investigations into the Hermetic mystery, Mary Atwood, one of the last of the great philosophical alchemists, gave a wonderful insight into the alchemistical mysteries of transmutation and projection. She sensed, although not able completely to unfold her project, that all these symbols of alchemical processes had to do with concentration disciplines. that they were chemistries and alchemies taking place within the consciousness of man himself. And that in some mysterious way, the base metal was dead knowledge, which had to be rescued and transformed into living truth. The elaborate chemistry by which this transmutation can take place is concealed in the basic writings of such old masters as Basilus Valentinus and Eugenius Philalethes. These knew, they realized that the great search for the golden lion, the powder of eternal projection, by which all things were transmuted from seemingness into substance, that this was an attained internal vision which could be then directed upon anything, and that thing upon which it was directed received it like light into its soul and blossomed and bore its fruit, and all substances became medicines for the healing of the sickness of ignorance. These contemplations, very mystical in their interpretation and in their wording, are strangely factual, however, when we come to the experiencing of them. Words and descriptions are more difficult than actual processes themselves. So in our concentration thinking, we have to do with this problem of bringing realities to life. The alchemist described this by rolling away the stone of the tomb so that the universal Messiah could rise from his grave. Thus the resurrection of Christ signified to them the resurrection of the realities in things, the victory of life over death, of truth over fact, of reality over substance. This truth, again, this achievement, must occur within ourselves. And this is achieved through the victory of the experienced over the intellectually contemplated. For experience is alive, but thought and argument and debate, these are not alive. We can believe anything and remain as we are. But when we experience something, we are changed. We are changed utterly. Something is added that can never again be taken away. So it is this experiencing and the conscious ability to benefit from experience, to accept experience, to judge it for its true worth. These are the elements which help us to self-realization, to the unfoldment of the powers and principles that are locked within ourselves. Now, there are several points this evening which we want to take up because I think they are more or less valuable. And in looking over chapter 7 in particular, I was impressed by the fact that in the years that have followed the writing of this book, my studies in the substance of the transcendent being is based upon Chinese metaphysics. Have been advanced considerably over the years. Therefore, while the substance is unchanged as far as what is contained in the book is concerned, we have additional material and commentary which may be added at this particular phase of the problem. To give some basic points in connection with the transcendent field in chapter 7, which we mentioned, and also something of the Chinese metaphysics by which this concept has gained general recognition, where it is first known to us in certain Chinese metaphysical works. But in the study of the transcendent being, we can go further. In the old description, this being is another self, an interior nature,
that gradually comes to have an existence of itself. As the embryo is carried in the body of the mother, so the transcendent being is locked in the heart of the disciple. As the child is finally born to have a separate and complete existence in itself, so ultimately the transcendent being is born. And in its birth and in its achievement of its own mature and individual state, the result means an important and wonderful transformation in man. A transformation suggested in Greek mysticism in the change from the chrysalis to the butterfly. And the use of the butterfly as a symbol of the liberated soul of man. The transcendent being is originally in man the germ of his realized self. The transcendent being is born when the individual begins to doubt whether things are as they appear to be. When he begins to doubt that he is just body, when he begins to doubt whether he must do exactly as he feels, when he begins to doubt that common knowledge is all knowledge, when these uncertainties begin to stir within him a certain inquiry, it is said that there gradually takes shape within his nature another being, and that this being continues to grow or unfold, as Goethe describes in Faust, where he says that there are two spirits competing in the flesh, that one of these spirits is nobler than the other, that one of these spirits is forever striving to lift man up to a greater achievement, and the other is constantly lulling him back into the rest of immaturity. We all have the double experience of this creature, so that we are sort of split personalities, regardless of whether it is so diagnosed or not. In these divisions of ourselves, there always seems to be one part that is the leader. If we are very materially poised, then the material part is the leader. If gradually, however, we sense that materiality is inadequate, then something else begins to take over. And we can divide these two natures into a basic idealist and a basic materialist. The materialist is a creature of its own comforts and desires. The idealist is a striver, a seeker, a spirit of discontent moving in us and moving us continually. The moment it comes to our realization that we can be better than we are, the nagging of this better self begins. It never seems to be willing to let us rest. And even in our securities and in our successes, it whispers to us that we have failed in something greater. After a time, this voice, like the voice of conscience, becomes a burden upon the spirit. We can no longer resist it. It is continually impelling us to seek and to strive, to recognize that there are distant horizons which must yet be explored. It is like the double nature of the man who stays at home, but in his dreams adventures through the seven seas. And there is this adventurer in us that is forever striving to break away from the general and the accepted and search the more distant and wonderful atmospheres for greater things. In time, this transcendent being becomes a sort of alter ego. It becomes our friend, developing a kind of personality in itself. In it we are investing continuously all those attributes and qualities which find no expression in our outer life.
the transcendent being becomes a sharer in our dreams, in our hopes, in our inner convictions. It becomes our friend in time of trouble. And as we turn more continuously to the inner part of ourselves for understanding, we seem to find it there. And in one way or another, we create an ever more visual image, something that becomes increasingly real until there are moments when it seems difficult to decide whether this transcendent being is ourselves or whether this outer person we have known so long is the real self. In the Chinese metaphysics, it is thought that as time goes on, this transcendent being gradually absorbs into itself the energies and powers that were originally vested in the outer personality. In due course, the rulership of life, the center of consciousness, moves from the personal, physical perspective of objectivity within us and becomes identified with the transcendent being. This being then becomes the real self. And it has absorbed the lesser self and becomes a living thing in itself, having created for its habitation a mysterious garment of energies which we call the soul. So that actually, from this soul substance, we fashion a new instrument of expression. We give a new kind of body, which is not of the earth, but a body which is a vestment of heaven. And having created this body, we finally move into it, inhabit it, and discover in it our normal instrument. For the ancients were convinced man was created and basic, a human soul. The body was a strange and distant and unwieldy thing, not natural to man. But that man inevitably seeks to escape from the domination of body and return to the psychic substance which is his true nature. Thus man becomes a living soul. And this soul is his proper instrument and vehicle, in which he then again involves and evolves, passing from one condition to another, until he exhausts the mystery of soul as he is now seeking to exhaust the mystery of body. This transcendent being, this intuitional over-self, is therefore as close to us as our own ability to sense it. And in meditation and in the various mystical disciplines, there are processes which encourage the development of this transcendent nature. Man turning from the consideration of temporal things to those things which are internal and eternal naturally gives the weight of his energy, his creative processes, and his experience mechanism to this inner growth. And this growth, therefore, gradually matures. The opposite situation is fairly obvious to us in psychological problems. Where the individual misuses his psychic content, where he becomes burdened by false attitudes, where he permits complexes and neurotic tendencies to take control, then he sickens his psychic life, which becomes a burden to him, and becomes the opposite of a transcendent being, rather appearing in the awful likeness of some monster or demon, threatening to destroy his normalcy and his peace of mind. But as surely as dissipation, corruption, and indifference breed their own monsters in the silence of our psychic selves, so the path of discipleship transforms all this, and transforms the bitter guardian upon the threshold of the astral light into the blessed and truly glorious soul likeness by which we gain this instrument of liberation and spiritual integrity. Thus, the transcendent being in the Chinese way of life is something that we gradually come to know and understand. And one day we step across the bridge, and the better self becomes the one and only self, whereas today there is division in our midst, conflict and uncertainty, a little aspiration and a great deal of resignation to negation. This development of the transcendent nature has been given a great deal of thought, particularly in Asia, and probably is the answer to many unsolved questions relating to the extrasensory perception range and to the projection of consciousness and intelligence from one place to another. For this higher being possesses much greater aptitude and much stronger abilities than those which we know in our daily living experiences. According to the Chinese, this transcendent being can travel around the world. It can go to the most distant places. It flies through the air on the back of a crane or rides a phoenix through the clouded sky. It is the mysterious being of inspiration. It is that which seemingly can dart instantly into the highest parts of the sky, penetrating with its inner vision into the deepest secrets of the universe. This transcendent being is therefore full of powers which we experience only in shadow or in part, but the reality of which we seem to sense. Also, this transcendent being represents not only the image of power, but the image of integrity. It is forever reminding us that only by certain procedures may we achieve to this Taoist paradise where the immortals gather around the peak tree of eternal youth. All of these principles and processes have their rules and laws. None can be broken, and the universe is in every part of itself completely and totally honest, accepting only honesty from those to whom it gives its richer blessings. So the way to immortality, as found in the mysterious journey of the Hung soldiers, is a very different and very peculiar path in correspondence to our daily thinking. It is not something that we can easily sense or understand, but which only gradually dawns upon us as we begin to seek in our own natures for the secrets of life. In the Chinese, for example, also, great emphasis is placed upon the motivations behind the various achievements of men. There are two primary ends which a human being can conceive in connection with knowledge. One is the glorification of himself, that he becomes one who knows, that he shares in this wonderful gnosis of things about which the ancients have written so much. And the second end is that he becomes the servant of knowledge, that actually he does not desire to possess. Rather, he desires to become possessed by these things which are true and right. One seeks mastery and the other to become the good and faithful servant. And the Chinese point out that the only one who can ever truly achieve is the one who dedicates himself as the servant. And woe to those who seek to master for their own gain. For to them, the illusion thickens and darkens. Every effort which they make is clouded by their own motives. And little by little, they are led along paths of self-deceit until everything becomes so confused and impossible that they are truly forlorn and helpless. Therefore, early in the disciplines of things, all self-interest must vanity, for self-interest is the parent of illusion. From self-interest, as from the mysterious hydra with its seven heads, one evil after another is born, and for every head that is cut off, seven more grow. Self-interest is in all things the secret of error. And even in our most common, objective daily life, there is nothing that more quickly condemns us to misery than self-interest. Yet we live in a time in which, apparently, self-interest is universal. Now, who shall say that the Chinese are less materialistic than we are? There are very few indeed who can out-bargain the Chinese. They have struggled long for the very sustenance which they need for survival. They are shrewd in barter and exchange, and in many ways are the most materialistic of people. Yet, from them we have had this wonderful doctrine, this Taoistic concept of total freedom from self-interest. How shall we understand this? I think one old Chinese scholar who happened to have been more or less contemporary, and whom I knew many years ago, answers the thing very simply. He says, most people get along reasonably well because they do not understand how to work their own vices. They think they're bad, but they're just foolish. Actually, it takes a great deal of skill to be bad, and it takes a great deal of concentration to develop a full-blown case of self-interest. Self-interest to the average person is just about as superficial as his truth-seeking. Self-interest is something that's important to him if it's easy, doesn't make much effort on his own part, he can get what he wants without trying too hard, or if he thinks he is taking care of his own activities and desires, then he is satisfied to relax and let someone else win the battle. Self-interest does not lead this person to a tremendous sacrifice of his own inertia, even here and now. It takes even more than self-interest to raise the horizontal human being to a vertical position. So self-interest is as half-baked as every other attitude, and consequently does but very little harm. We had years ago an epidemic of individuals trying to do yoga exercises. They really worked at it terrifically for anywhere from 2 to 3 days. Of course, if they had a large enough investment, they might last for a week or two. But during the course of that week or two, they had already broken every rule of the art or of the discipline. This was as it should be. These persons practiced their yoga so badly, so poorly, so irregularly, and so foolishly that it really didn't do them any harm. If they had been more sincere, the insanity rate would have gone up very rapidly. But they did not work hard at it, not hard enough even to make themselves sick. They couldn't have done it right, they did not know how. But they did not have patience to do it wrong. So in a few days, not getting immediate results, they were off to some shorter path. Nothing happened except a little loss of money, a little loss of time, and perhaps a few bad cases of nerves. In the same way, self-interest, which is such a deadly enemy to these problems, would be much more dangerous if man had the stamina to even be selfish consistently. But he does not. Occasionally, one does have this degree of stamina and gets into rather serious trouble. But for the most part, our self-interest is not deep set. It is mostly a cultivation of creature comforts. It is a series of lazy decisions, not motivated by any great amount of ill, but simply lacking the stamina of rightness. So our negative situations are not helpless or hopeless or terrible, nor will self-interest in most cases cause us serious difficulties. The only thing that we must remember is that if we continue to cultivate it in a half-hearted manner, it will delay the gradual integration of the personality, which must be built upon certain basic convictions. The person does not need to get too regretful or blame himself too much. It is simply wiser to assume that the moment we understand, at that moment we gain a new responsibility to live according to what we understand. What went before, we may as well release it, rather than trying to be sorry or work some weird penance to seek the forgiveness for our sin. Most people are not really successful sinners to the degree that a great repentance is indicated. They're just neither hot nor cold, and the Bible says that these have a difficult time. In the development, then, of all these disciplines, the motivation is gradually to eliminate the various elements which go to make up the self-pressure pattern. Where self-pressure is perhaps even more obvious than self-interest as we know it, although the two terms are difficult sometimes to differentiate. Actually, we sit in a kind of judgment perpetually over the things we see and the experiences that pass through our consciousness. We say to ourselves, this is a symbol of this. This experience means this. We have all decided it. We know exactly, according to our preconceptions, how we are going to accept what we term to be fact. And always we are seeking to justify the previous structure of beliefs, those attitudes which we hold most closely and cherish most intimately. We are therefore living forever to prove that we are right. We are constantly bewildered and disappointed when we realize how right we are and how wrong everything goes that we have anything to do with. We can only conclude that the universe is disorderly. It is impossible for us to deserve anything but the best. And as we seldom get it, universal ethics has gone awry. This removal of the personal equation is the beginning of honest experience. In meditation and concentration particularly, it is most important that we do not interpret the truth out of everything that we experience. And in an effort to not make these mistakes as we go along, there is this need for an occasional pause to look into ourselves more intimately. In concentration, our own honesty is our most valuable instrument. And our own honesty means, for the most part, a complete suspension of judgment. Honesty is a very difficult thing to define in its detail or in its actual substance. We say that certain things are honest and certain things are dishonest, and we try to be honest, but we really are toying with words rather than ideas. The only safe way to be honest in an interior experience is simply to suspend all judgment. The moment we try even to be most honorable, we are limited by our own concept of what is honorable, or by the world concept, or by the concept of our neighbors, or the dictates of our religion. We are never sure just exactly what this honesty is. And the best way to try to find out is to sort of remove ourselves from the picture and let the facts have their own works. realizing always that if we are able to suspend our own personalities, then we can accept unconditioned experience. So it's one thing to try to do this, and it's another thing to achieve it. Because many of our dishonesties are subconscious. And many of the other elements in which we have uncertainties in this department are along lines of very special feelings which we have nurtured and nursed with great love and attention for a long time. We have cuddled many of the weakest and worst phases of our own natures. And our honesty, which must be a suspension of personal judgment, cannot escape from the interferences and inroads of personal likes and dislikes. Judgment is one thing, intensity is another. And where judgment is suspended, intensity may come along and destroy everything. So we look back over the problem of the life, and we recognize the cathartic disciplines as set forth for us. The vital necessity of suspending all of these habit patterns which affect our temperaments adversely. Now, I know many people who have great respect for the brotherhood of man, but they've never been able to find a brother they could live with. Humanity is wonderful, except those that they know. These same people are utterly dedicated to the service of people they have never met. Because these people they have never met appreciate them tremendously. They're sure of it. But the people they have met do not seem to appreciate them so well. And as a result, there is less sympathy and rapport, shall we say. It is also very easy for us to be extremely patient in matters where we have no interest. We can be more tolerant of how the Chinese or the Greeks run their affairs than even appears to be necessary. We simply cannot tolerate the way our own children run their affairs. Now we're in a personal situation. So we can forgive everybody whom we have never heard of. We can get along with everyone we've never met. And we have a fair ability to rise to those monumental heights in which we are able to be patient with individuals who do exactly what we want them to. Such virtues as these overwhelm us, but they mean nothing when we try to grow. Actually, each one is blocked in his growth by the negative aspects of his own temperament. Unless he really goes to work on himself, he is never going to be able to break through into these areas in which inner strength will be available to meet the pressing need of the day. Now, persons who have not accomplished all these wonderful ends can still be tremendously useful people. A good intention, a good resolution, this also helps tremendously. And it is part of the way in which nature permits us to grow. Nature does not issue any ultimatum at the early period of the growth of anything. Nature never at any time points a finger at someone and says, "You shall not do this." Nature works in a very subtle and general manner, but its ways are irresistible. Thus, the person who has not made these grand achievements